This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Put aside Mr. Trump for a moment and ask yourself, when was the last time a president really delivered on all that was promised? Now, is that the fault of the candidate or something else? Well, a thought-provoking new book explores the history of the holders of America's top office, suggesting that whoever wins the election these days is going to have a tough time winning once president. Even the most competent modern president is destined to fail. Jeremy Suri is a professor at UT's LBJ School, author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. You seem to be making the point, Jeremy, that by design, this office wasn't built to do everything we expect it to.
One of the important points of departure is to recognize that the founders didn't know what the office was going to be. There had been nothing like it before.
Although you're right, Jefferson did imagine, he did imagine that the presidency could become almost too unwieldy.
That's correct. In fact, Jefferson had a premonition of where we've gone, which is that American power, he feared, would diminish American virtue. And that's part of what's happened.
I wonder, though, if as we talk about what we expect out of our presidents, if we sort of need to do a reality check here, because one of the points that you make in your book is that it's not just that America has grown and become so much bigger and so much more of a player on the world stage, but in a sense, our expectations have kind of gotten too big as a result of some pretty successful presidents.
Absolutely. This is a great point, David. Our expectations have grown because we've received more. Our presidents did so well early on, and because of a certain sense of entitlement that we've developed as well. And so the combination of an entitlement culture and the history, sometimes exaggerated history, of the successes of our presidents leads us to expect more at lower cost. And in fact, the world doesn't work that way.
You got to say more about this entitlement culture, because I think a lot of people are going to feel like, I don't feel entitled. I just want a competent person at the helm.
Yes, but the founders expected, and our early generations of leaders expected, that citizens would be part of the collective sacrifice required for their leaders to succeed. But unfortunately, we've told the history of some of the presidents I describe, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, as if they're doing all the work. And as a consequence, later generations of Americans think they can get the benefits from leaders like that without having to make the sacrifice that the citizens who lived under Theodore Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln made for them. Take the Civil War, for example.
Yeah.
We often talk about the war and we talk about the battles, but we don't talk about the sacrifices across American society that were responsible for the United States to come out of that war not only intact, but actually stronger than when it went into that war.
Well, one of the most interesting developments that I think we've seen in at least modern American history has been this turn toward globalism. But as you write, you look back at Teddy Roosevelt, who
yes.
in a way sort of internationalized America. We sort of take that for granted, I think.
That's a great point. Yes, globalization is not new. What it means today is different from what it meant 100
right,
years ago.
Right.
But I would say that Theodore Roosevelt was as global a thinker as anyone today. He had a vision of the world and the United States being a part of it as a diplomatic actor, as an economic actor, and as a military and ideological leader. Now, he did not expect the United States to be the first among all countries, but he expected the United States to be engaged. And here's the most important point. He recognized that the future of the United States was tied to the globe.
Yes, he did. But something else came along the way, and that's this idea that we have to be number one, too, right? I mean, isn't there this element, as you were talking about this, this expectation that if the United States is going to play this part on the world stage, as Roosevelt and his successors have imagined, that it doesn't mean anything unless we come away with a win?
Yes, I think that's true. I think that really is a post-World War II phenomenon. Americans have always been proud of our special history. That goes back to the 18th century. But the sense that, by definition, we're the leaders of the world, that's really a post-World War II phenomenon. Americans did not believe that in the 1930s. And that's another case where we're a victim of our own successes. We did so well in World War II at great cost, and then we were able to make such an imprint on the world after World War II that we've come to expect that we can do that in all eras. And one of the points I make in the book is that presidents have to be more selective, not more selective in where we send our resources, more mm-hmm. selective in which issues we focus upon. We spend a lot of time debating isolation versus engagement or big government versus small government. Mm-hmm. Those are false debates for a historian. What really matters is where do you put your emphasis? There are areas where government should probably be more involved at home and abroad mm-hmm. and areas where government should be less involved. That's not big or small. That's about the selectivity of your strategy.
I know that this doesn't really fit into the framework that you've put together for the Impossible Presidency, but I have to ask, what would you consider to be the last great successful American presidency.
I think the truly last great president was Franklin Roosevelt, and he's the hero of my book, but FDR. Also a tragic figure, because he creates this presidency that provides for so much healing at home during the time of depression, mm-hmm. an extraordinary victory in war, and begins the reconstruction of the world. I mean, those are pretty big accomplishments, but what he's taken on as an agenda is undoable for anyone after him, because that agenda continues to grow. The way I put it is he's the last president who can build the office up and still barely manage to keep it working. And after him, it becomes very difficult for other presidents. One of my points is that we've had many, many talented presidents since Roosevelt, but the structure of the office has prevented them from succeeding on the scale he succeeded.
The structure of the office, you're taking it right back to the founding? Is that
absolutely. I think what's happened over time is this office, which from the founding is about a mix of things. The president is commander in chief. The president is part king. The president is part legislator. Mm-hmm. The president is there for natural disasters. All of these things together, when the office begins, it's small, and the president can do it. He can be a dilettante in a sense. But over time, as each of these issue areas becomes more complex and becomes larger, it's a juggling act that you need thousands and thousands of arms for, and that makes it impossible for the president to do it. It also makes the president beholden to other people, particularly smaller actors.
What if someone were to say, let's take a look at those blueprints.
Mm-hmm.
Let's fix something.
Mm-hmm.
Are there one or two things you would say, here's something you got to take care of in the short term?
Sure. So one thing I argue is that the president's doing too many things. She or he needs more help. And we need another national elected official who can take on some of the responsibility.
Vice president isn't enough?
Well, the vice president isn't really elected, right? The vice president is there because the president put him on the ticket, right? And the vice president doesn't have legitimacy in many contexts. But imagine if someone like Speaker Paul Ryan were chosen not by the extreme members of the Republican caucus, but were chosen by the nation as a whole. It could be even from a different party than the president, but that individual would actually have responsibility to the people as a whole when forming legislation. In fact, the founding fathers expected the vice president to be elected separately. And we merged them together in the 19th century, we might go back to having what a business leader would call a CEO and a CFO. Second thing we might do is invest more in knowledge institutions. I am frustrated like everyone else with all the fake news out there. But the fake news doesn't just exist because there are people making fake news. It exists because we have systematically underfunded knowledge-producing objective institutions. The founders expected those would be the basis for our politics.
The informed citizenry.
We could invest in that. We need more NPRs and more Texas standards, and we need more universities. I'm serious about that. And if you don't like NPRs that exist now, why don't we have two of them? It costs next to nothing. And the point here would be to make information not dependent on revenue from profit making and commerce, but make it dependent on the pursuit of the truth.
That's Jeremy Suri. He's a professor and chair for leadership and global affairs at the LBJ School, and he is author of the new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office.